Hi everybody, I'm here with Jamie Wheel. Jamie is a writer and the founder of the Flow Genome Project. He's the author of the Pulitzer Prize nominated Stealing Fire, as well as Recapture the Rapture. He's also written and spoken extensively on the psychedelic renaissance and the pros and cons of what happens when altered states go mainstream. So Jamie, welcome.
Hi there, how are you?
Yeah, good, good. So, Jamie, we've had conversations like this a few times in the past, and actually the past is where I wanted to start because since about 2018 or so, you've been warning about the potential downsides of the psychedelic renaissance and the psychedelic capitalism, which we've talked about before as well. We're 6 years on from 2018. I'm curious to maybe you could give people a bit of a sense of what your concerns have been with psychedelic capitalism and how you see the field now.
Sure. I mean, and warnings and concerns almost seems a little fraught. It was more sort of like, hey, this looks like the trends and trajectories, so we should at least be aware of them, And so I would say, yeah, in the before times, so this was 2017, 2018, sort of tracking all things countercultural and state shifting, everything from tier one special operations folks to Silicon Valley to transformational things like Boom Festival or Burning Man in the States, to the beginnings of the psychedelic renaissance. Just saying, what does it look like is going to happen based on the big trends? And I remember giving a talk to a San Francisco psychedelic conference and saying, hey, look, we are here in the, Gartner is a research institution, and they famously came up with the Gartner hype cycle, which is basically inflated expectations, trough of disillusionment, and then you kind of climb back to the other side with some sort of more realistic level set sort of thing. This happens with pharmaceutical drug releases like Prozac gonna save the world or OxyContin or any of those, right? And then we kind of end up with a more level set experience. The same thing you could say with AI, right? We're probably off the peak of illusions and excitement and froth and heading towards it's not all that, or it's got mixed bags, or that kind of thing. So all I did was just say, hey, we're probably going to follow a similar arc when it comes to this psychedelic renaissance. But the catch or the twist right now is we're also facing a polycrisis or a meta crisis or whatever we'd say. So we really don't have the time to burn and the sort of calories to waste diving down into that trough like we did in the 60s and 70s. So is there a way to go from the excitement and the froth of 2018, let's say, to now 2024 and not go through that dip? And part of the things that were pulling us into that dip were structural. So it didn't require a crystal ball, and it didn't require any particular skills or wisdom or insight to simply say, oh, psychedelics are going from an underground countercultural movement to an above ground market-based movement. And if you're plugging things into the market, as Rick Doblin, the founder of MAPS, the predominant nonprofit organization that has really been both socializing, validating, and now legalizing access to psychedelics in the US and elsewhere, he made a decision. It was a strategic decision, and this started 30 years ago, but it was, can we get these compounds, specifically psychedelics, validated as medical interventions? And if you do that, right, you both squish and de-emphasize any of the historic anthropological, spiritual, religious elements, magical, mystical elements of those states, and you medicalize them. So this is relevant because it might, prompt you to stop smoking or alleviate depression or cure insomnia or anxiety or anything else that's in the, at least in the States, the DSM-5, the Diagnostic of Statistical Manuals. It's a coded illness. Doctors can write it. You can get copay insurance to do, all of that. So that was one big switch that got thrown. And it was a sort of calculated deal with the devil. It both worked to validate and sort of bring these things out of the underground and out of marginalized counterculture to say, look, these are worthwhile and there's hurting people that need them, and that's important and medical, as well as the emphasis on veterans for PTSD. If anybody has been following, oh wow, I've read something about psilocybin or MDMA for our noble red-blooded soldiers. God bless them, right? That also was a strategic marketing decision. And it was saying, hey, this is the most sympathetic populace. Not, I mean, of course, there's plenty of humans that suffer abysmal trauma, including children, including women, domestic violence, sexual violence, all these things. But the thought was, hey, this is the best thing to cross the aisle politically. So conservatives who have been the bulwark against this kind of stuff, against lefty counterculture, Enviro, you know, all the kind of things, now couldn't say no because, you know, it's the Oscar Wilde, you know, patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel, right? So Rick, in a little bit of trickster judo, turned that back and harnessed patriotism to psychedelic medical validation. So, you know, that's just kind of a landscape of the strategies underpinning what got us to now people reading about the psychedelic renaissance. But that also had the kind of the Faustian bargain / Rumpelstiltskin back end, which was, if you're going to go down the medical route, if you are now going to be in the realm of big pharma, drug procedures, development, validation, launch into the healthcare systems of whatever country you're in, and that's going to attract capital, venture capital in this instance. And once you have for-profit money coming into the system, things are going to behave probably like they do in many, many, many other industries. So you end up with, you know, and Rick has said this just recently at South by Southwest, the tech festival in Austin. And he basically said, you know, at a private dinner that we were at together on behalf of fundraising for MAPS, he said, you know, we were a victim of our own success. We actually did such a good job of telling and enrolling this nonprofit story, and that we are going to both validate and gain approval for, in this case, specifically MDMA trauma work. And then we're going to be the world's first nonprofit pharmaceutical company with exclusive rights to manufacture and distribute for licensed therapeutic use of MDMA. And then that is going to be this wonderful profit machine, but not in a greedy corporate way, but in a way to then fund and further the impact of all the positive nonprofit activities. So bold model, really neat subversion, and it had a lot of heartfelt support among the kind of Silicon Valley billionaire philanthropist Amanda Fieldings, and they're around the world, right? But there was that sort of cognoscenti of baby boomer generation philanthropy and support for this stuff, as well as younger up and comers. And you know, as Rick said, we became a victim of our own success by validating this field and by choosing the medical pharmacological lane to both tell this story and gain traction. We now suddenly, all the light bulbs went on in the, you know, venture capital space, and you saw this explosion from 2018 until now of for-profit psychedelic ventures. And whether that's things like ketamine clinics, or whether that's pharmacological, you know, companies where they're like, let's tweak a molecule here and there, let's patent it. Compass Pathways is one that you have written about and thought about in the past. There's a whole lot of them. And then the ecosystem shifted. And suddenly all of those wonderful, generous philanthropists who are like, hey, psychedelics have changed my life. I feel like I want to come out of the closet. I want to be able to support this stuff. You guys are doing the Lord's work, right? Here's a big fat check. We're suddenly like, tell me why I don't just invest in one of those for-profit companies and make bank. Why would I just set millions on fire supporting you guys, puny nonprofit? And so as a result, you know, not long ago, probably 6 months ago, 9 months ago, MAPS spun out their public benefit company and turned it, renamed it Lycos, which is, you know, an ironic name, it being a wolf, you know, a wolf in Molly's clothing. And they've created a for-profit, because it was the only way they were able to then go ahead and raise investment, not donation, to then be able to get it across the goal line and get through phase three trials and actually get to market. So those things aren't surprising, right? If you just think of the ratchets of corporate governance, fiduciary responsibility, and all of those kind of things. And in the US, it's Milton Friedman, the famous slash infamous kind of free market economist at the University of Chicago. You know, that became instantiated in law by like 1985, that in fact, the sole responsibility of board members, right, and a company was to return maximum stockholder value, you know, to its owners. And anything less was, you could literally be sued. You were liable if you didn't do that. So you have just certain things like that in place. And then these outcomes are not that surprising. So that was one, you know, and when you see those market dynamics, you realize, oh, everyone always says, I mean, it's a catechism, you know, psychedelics in conjunction with talk therapy, right? So, and everybody has to say that, because that's like not raving with your mates at Glastonbury, right? Like in conjunction with talk therapy, you're like, and you realize, oh, wait, that's a very high touch, delicate, and therefore high cost, not scalable model. And what you would naturally see in that space, if the number one responsibility, once we've signed the papers, is maximum profitability in something that's actually dealing with people's immortal souls, right, is going to be an erosion of the standard of care down to the puppy mill. So you'll see the telemedicine, you know, and COVID accelerated some of this stuff. We ended up with some suspension of rules, some loosening of rules, so that people can now telemedicine, go online, get ketamine sent to their house. We'll have a Zoom call. You okay? Make sure you've got to stay away from sharp objects and have a friend to drive you home. Good, good, right? And like, don't let that, like, hope, let's hope that doesn't go terribly wrong. And once you've had that as a price point, you can't get back. I mean, this is Clayton Christensen at Harvard. He was a very famous Harvard Business School professor, and he had this notion of the innovator's dilemma. And the innovator's dilemma was, you come into a space, you create something new, better, different, that's of use and value to people, yay, capitalism, right? But then you get undercut by incumbents or insurgents who then try to beat you on price at the lower end. And once they've established, once they claim market share there, then they kind of eat your lunch all the way up the value chain. So this is Hyundai and Kia, you know, which for years were cheesy knockoff cars and are now actually breaking into really nicely designed. They poached a few of Tesla's car designers. They're leading on a bunch of things, and now they're owning the middle of the market, right? So you can kind of see that innovator's dilemma. And that was a big dynamic in market capitalism that psychedelics probably wouldn't be immune to. And sure enough, they haven't been. And we've seen a huge collapse in the last 18 to 24 months of a lot of those giddily funded go-go growth companies. And they all piled into the ketamine therapy space because it's the first one that was legal. So they're like, let's get our feet wet and let's figure out our operations and build an audience and a market. And then when MDMA and psilocybin and all the others come online, then we'll really go huge. And many of them have just been cannibalized by this race to the bottom. And then suddenly, where is the investment and the dollars, you know, dollars or pounds and time and space for the dedicated clinicians who are really committed to the serving and healing of people? Where on earth can they afford to do the good work that's necessary? So that's a bit of a kind of meandering tale from 5 to 10 years ago to now. Really just saying that when you pour, you know, when we poured the sort of, you know, quicksilver magic of the psychedelic experience into the medical, pharmacological, and market investment space, this is what one would expect. And, you know, sadly, it's turned out to be pretty much exactly that with surprisingly few variations, even for the icons in the space like MAPS and their public benefit company.
Yeah, no, really nicely described. Thank you. And I think especially for someone who wasn't tracking that, which is probably most of our audience, it's very important to understand what's gone on over the last few years. There's something in what you described that I'd love to drill into a little bit, which is this this narrative around psychedelics that developed quite intentionally. I've called it the psychedelic Trojan horse of like, we'll get it into culture through the medical model. And then once it's in there, it'll open out and all the wonderful countercultural magic will spew into society, which I think is very flawed. But I think there is this juxtaposition between psychedelics as medical tools, as they've been, you know, if you read a newspaper article about psychedelics, it's taking that angle very often, right? Because that's the culturally accepted, understood, easy to get across. I'm curious to hear your thoughts about what's lost in that narrative, because you already mentioned the countercultural, the indigenous, all these other aspects of psychedelics that until very recently were the main way people understood psychedelics. So what do you think we've, what are some of the things we've lost in this process of medicalization?
Yeah, I mean, all sorts of thoughts on that. You know, I think the first is we've lost any cultural context, any initiatory process, and any sense of kind of maps of meaning making. So effectively, what are our scriptures around a ritual that used to provide initiation? And that's for 99.9% of all of human existence. That is how and the only way that humans have ever related to these compounds and the experiences these compounds typically generate. So just rip all of that out. And then you've got medical folks being like, we really need to focus more on integration, which just means, oh, you blew somebody's, you know, world apart with an IV and a clinic with fluorescent lights and a vinyl chair, and you're trying to send them home, and they're having a bit of a hard time going home now. And you're like, oh, we need to build out an integration protocol. We're like, that's called culture. You know, that's called ritual. That's called a rite of passage. So we've just ripped all of that up. And then, you know, more sort of playfully, if anybody remembers the Hunter Thompson book, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, you know, he's got famous opening lines. It's like, we were somewhere outside of Barstow, California, when the drugs began to kick in, right? You know, and they pick up a hitchhiker and they're just peeking on whatever the hell they had in their trunk. And he's like, well, when are we going to tell that poor bastards about the bats? You know, no worries. He'll see them soon enough, you know? And to me, there's that question too. In fact, our mutual friend and colleague, Dr. Julie Holland, right, who's a prominent psychedelic therapist and clinician, she recently posted something on Twitter about, you know, DMT shown to alleviate depression in some patients. And you're like, yeah, along with a complete ontological shattering of your reality. And if you get, you know, if you get a microphone or, you know, or a recorder stuck in your face half an hour afterwards, you're like, I don't feel so depressed anymore. You know, wow, that my petty concerns are blown out the window during the launch phase. But then that capital M more, which I've just been experienced, can produce euphoria. It can produce senses of liberation. It can produce senses of even just sort of manic excitement of, oh my gosh, I was leading a life of quiet desperation, and now the world is enchanted, and I'm a superhero, and, you know, et cetera, like fill in the blank of your far furthest out fantasies. But after that initial, you know, euphoric uptick comes the realization, oh, my quiet life of desperation persists. And now I'm not just trying to wrestle with that. How do I make rent or pay a mortgage or do a job that I don't hate, you know, and raise children that actually love me and deal with aging parents in a world that seems off the rail, like the human. Now I've got to also include the bats and machine owls and anything else. And that is a vastly more complex worldview to sort out and wrestle with, especially if just the day-to-day was getting me down. So I think it's the height of, I don't even know what, I mean, naivety, irresponsibility to think that killing canaries with a cannon, you know, is the best way to deal with our sort of suburban mental health issues. I have very, very low confidence that longitudinally, so 5 years, 10 years, developmental arcs of actual people, that is going to be a magic bullet in the slightest.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree with that, you know, especially having been on, you know, probably the most intense DMT trial in history, as an extremely experienced psychonaut, and then asking, you know, I was obviously curious to the researchers, like, why are we doing this? You know, why are we getting to be injected with DMT for 40 minutes, you know? And they were like, well, you know, for the potential medical benefits in the future is one of the answers. And I thought, but the sheer amount of training and philosophy and everything else that you need to have to even handle the experience is really considerable. So I'm curious about to dive into that a little bit about you've written about this, like how human beings have actually come into, communitas with each other, come into like deep connection with each other and ritual. How might we, let's say best case scenario, start introducing some of that into perhaps not the medical model, but just society more generally, like how can we come back to some sense of having initiatory experiences, having ritual experiences with one another, so that we at least get a bit closer to not being in that vinyl chair and then going off back into the suburbs after our minds have been blown.
Yeah, I mean that is a million-dollar question, and sort of fools rush in, right? We're having absolutely, it's almost a trope to say our men or our boys are suffering because they don't have rites of passage anymore, and our women, let's do period parties for our little girls, and let's do moon gatherings, and name it, right? Like there's all that in the kind of new age sort of countercultural druids at Avalon space, right? And the question is are the people who are pioneering some of those or seeing that opportunity, are they the actually best ones? And are the things they're building true and helpful? Because in the past, and this isn't to like idealize traditional culture, but it is to say that if nothing else, it iterated slowly, right? People weren't just sort of making it up out of whole cloth. Every generation, there was some accumulation of things that worked, right? And there was some relative stability to a lineage. It didn't mean it wasn't confining or constraining or bigoted or something. It could be wrong-headed in a thousand ways, but as a cultural meme, they were sort of validated and pressure tested. Where now you can have goddess circle gatherings where, the girls involved, might not even know Rion Eisler and the Chalice and the Blade, or Clarissa Pinkola Estes and Women Who Run with the Wolves and Starhawk. And they might not even know that last generation, which was iterative of stuff from the early to mid 20th century Gardnerian Wicca to James Frazer to, Madame Blavatsky. Like, no understanding of any of that, let alone that even that stuff was made up and derivative of prior ancient traditions, and so you've just got Insta-talk, therapy, spirituality, masquerading as replacements to grounded former lineage traditions of initiation. So that's all to say there's this gaping hole. Most people are aware of that these days, but who's coming in to fill it quite often have sloppy scholarship and perverse incentives. And there's almost always a click on the link below to sign up for my, Starseed initiation clinic or workshop or whatever the hell it might be. And you're like, ah, that's not going to get us there either. So my current thinking is if it's all a lie, pick good ones. And wouldn't it be fun to do some kind of resurrection of Fraser's Golden Bough, which is kind of the original, 19th century super influential story of the sacrificial king. Right. And that then influenced Robert Graves, that influenced everybody from Joseph Campbell to Tom Robbins, the popular fiction writer writing about Jitterbug Perfume and all these things. So like it's in our zeitgeist, it's in our stories, it's shaped so many people. So pick them. And then Robert Graves wrote The White Goddess, which is all about the triple goddess, right? The maiden, mother, crone. And then that influenced ecofeminism, et cetera. So why not be like, it's all lies slash ripping yarns. Pick some good ones that are resonant, and then let's stand up basically postmodern, mystery schools that, with a nod and a wink and an asterisk, if you go to the bottom of the page, we know we made this up, but we're doing it on purpose with some style and a nod and a wink, so they can be functional. And Ken Kesey wrote The One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and his narrator, and he came, his insight to write it this way came on mescaline. He's like, oh, I'm going to write this narrated by this 6 foot 6 giant American Indian from the Pacific Northwest. And his opening story is this, just this, in an insane asylum. So he's writing about, lunacy, sanity, the machine. And at the end of it, he goes, and it's the truth, even if it didn't happen. Right? Which feels to me about where we are in our postmodern, post-truth meaning crisis-y space to then try and assert something is actually true or literally true or exclusively true feels like a sort of fool's errand. But to have playful ripping yarns that work seems like an infinitely rich creative, you know, workbench or play space for us to come together around.
Yeah, lovely. Nice. I like that. Tacking back to psychedelics somewhat for the last thing I wanted to ask you about, this is something I've asked quite a few people is, well, normally I ask, what's your hope for the future of this area, the future of psychedelics? And I perhaps should ask as well, you know, what's your hope and what's the realist in you see happening as well? You know, perhaps those things can blend together, but yeah, so I'm curious about that.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, they do. So, you know, if anybody hasn't been following this, there are roughly three buckets. We've spoken about the kind of medicalization model. The next is the religious model. So that is literally church sanctions, nonprofit status, court protections of freedom to worship and freedom to practice these as sacraments, right? So that's another category. And then the third category is sort of so obvious that we often don't name it, which is the underground. And if you take a look across all three, sort of a portfolio analysis of how's this going to go, likely, right, you can see that the medical investment market-based model is and already has given us Prozac Nation 2.0 with new improved 5-HT2A receptor sites. Yay, right? It's the sort of carrying on of big pharma, medical pathologization of mental health and serotonergic insertions, just like Prozac, right? But with a little bit more whiz and bang. And we might even engineer out the whiz and the bang, you know, so it's purely a biomechanical, you know, or neurochemical fix. So we are getting Prozac Nation 2.0. It will be denatured, it will be demystified, it will be commodified, it will be scaled, it will be hyper efficient, it will be largely soulless, and it might work a bit anyway. Right. So that and if people are wringing their hands and super, super bummed that that's not the age of Aquarius and that wasn't this new, you know, that wasn't, that's not going to save us from our polycrisis. It's like it never could have or would have, but it's okay. Right. But let's make no bones about where that trends. Then the middle one is church. And even no sooner had I sort of been like, huh, I think that's probably, I wrote my most recent book, Recapture the Rapture, kind of about this sort of meaning collapse and this rise of new religiosity. And as soon as I was kind of tracking that, I was like, oh, I think what's next is going to be churches. And sure enough, I mean, showing up faster than imagined are all of these new psychedelic churches. And quite often by Anglos, by, you know, by mainstream culture folks, not by indigenous folks. And we're seeing, you know, my preference would be, hey, if you are a member of the mainstream culture, so you just have kind of privileged rights and accesses, it really would be a nice thing. And many First Nations and Indigenous tribes and peoples and communities are asking us to do this, which is stay the hell out of our lane, please. And that's true in the United States. There's a whole decriminalized nature political program, and it's got the backing of a number of kind of psychedelic advocates, et cetera, et cetera. And the Indian, so the American Indian advocates of the Native American Church are saying, please don't include peyote, our sacred plant, in your decriminalization efforts. That will blow it open. That will stress the handful of places we can still grow these things that take years to grow. It will flood our zone with a bunch of new age white folks coming in and strip mining our culture one more time. You know, and we fought really, really hard over centuries of oppression, boarding schools trying to stamp out our faith. Like we created this. We fought for it. We finally have Supreme Court protections. Please, please, for the love of God, leave this lane for us. We need it. So that is a heartfelt plea that I would absolutely second that, and it's not happening. We've got tons of big dumb hat wearing, you know, self-appointed Instagram shamans from Ibiza to Tulum to everywhere else of like, I'm going to be my own guru, and we're just going to be able to party without getting busted by the cops, right? And we can frame it as a nonprofit, and we're good to go. So that's going to happen, and it will probably result in, you know, a schism, as I've just described, between indigenous communities of lineage practices and a whole bunch of folks rushing in seeking, you know, opportunistic refuge, right? Slash self-aggrandizing positioning of I'm enlightened, I'm the you know, minister of the medicines, I'm a guru, I'm whatever. So that's going to likely be a mad, mad spike in cultic tendencies and train wrecks. And so if you see those first two, you're like, well, if the pharmaceutical model gives us Prozac Nation 2.0, and the church model gives us a bunch of gurus with feet of clay, and or the last gasps of neocolonialism, you know, like, let's come back and strip mine the stuff you guys figured out how to do in the last 500 years, because we're getting a little desperate ourselves, like, horrible. Let's not do that, but it's going to happen. Then the final one is just back to where we started, which is the underground. And that's honestly where my hope lies, because it's where it's always lain. So for thousands of years, there have always been the Prometheans stealing fire from the gods. There have always been the priests, you know, whether they're wearing black cassocks or men in black suits, the CIA in MK Ultra or any of these things, or, you know, or it's just simply the powers that be. They're always looking to hunt down and stamp out the Prometheans. And the Prometheans go underground, and then they pop up in some other time and place. And that has been this persistent story, right, for thousands of years, which is the esoteric underground has always found a way to keep that flame alive. And we've always done it in organic communities. And it's person to person, it's nature, right? It's place, it's emergent, bottoms up rituals, community, culture, customs, right? You could take a look at the Grateful Dead as a psychedelic carrier of this for 50 years, right? They had their own songs, they had their own lyrics, people would print them on t-shirts, they'd put them on bumper stickers, they traveled around the world following them. That was their scripture. They had a litany. What happens in the second set when the band really gets cracking and everybody's on acid at the same time, right? There was another funny bumper sticker I saw, you know, on a water bottle, which was like, set breaks are weird, right? Because everybody would drop at the beginning of the show, they'd play the first 90 minutes, and then they'd take a long ass break. And meanwhile, everyone's peaking and has nothing to do, you know? So you're like, oh, that's funny, right? And then second set, songs and stories that lead people home. Burning Man, Boom Fest, there's plenty. I mean, 90s rave culture had its peace, love, unity, respect, right? Like plur culture. So it's those movements in ones and twos and small groups of friends in larger communities that bubble up and inevitably collapse again. Like, to me, it's that kind of ephemeral, grassroots, human to human passing of the torch that I have indefinite hope in, simply because it's got a track record of thousands of years of persisting in the face of all sorts of challenge.
Amen to that. Yeah, Jamie, thank you for that. That's I share that vision actually, you know, and I think that's the resilience of it reminds me of the resilience of mycelium, you know. I think people use that metaphor, but I think it's kind of apt, right? It's just this kind of strength underground. So, wonderful. Thank you again for joining us.
For sure. Great, great, great to wrap as always, Ali.